Chapter 5. ST. The Small Craftsman Home in Ravenna, Seattle, Washington, USA. I burst through the kitchen window, dropping the plastic bag at the last second. The bottles containing Big Jim's life sustenance bounced off the window ledge, rolling onto the grass below. I dove through the kitchen, the living room, and shot down the concrete stairs to the basement, forgetting to inhale. Big Jim was up close to the wall where I'd left him, swaying as he dragged his nub of a finger. He'd have to replace that when he felt better. Relief rippled through me. No sign of Dennis. I took off in search of that lumpish codpiece. Dennis was in the laundry room. He was lying on a pile of Big Jim's soiled boxers, head on black padded teddy bear paws. The copious copper skin folds of his forehead hung low, obscuring his eyes. Facial wrinkles splayed on the laundry room floor. His hideous turkey neck wattle, which normally looks like a water buffalo's testicles, now resembled a discarded pancake. Dennis lifted an eyebrow and a mountain of skin, exposing the melancholiest of melancholy chestnut eyes, then resumed his carpet impression with a chesty sigh. He pretty much stayed that way for days. And then Dennis stopped eating. This signified another major change in our already topsy-turvy lives. I'd known Dennis since he was a rumpled dumpling who tripped over his own ears, back when he still had hope of mental evolution and keeping his balls. He'd always been a clay-brained barnacle, but I'd never seen him like this. I suspected that even a visitation from the UPS man, the sworn enemy of canines everywhere and Dennis's arch-nemesis, couldn't have roused him. Dennis had succumbed to his own ailment. He'd been ambushed by an invisible assassin, which had blown into his body uninvited and was slowly eating his heart from the inside out. It drank his hope and anesthetized his feelings. Depression. When you are depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways. Sadness, loss of interest, anxiety. Cymbalta can help. Big Jim listened to that commercial on repeat one day whilst downing Malibu and Coke before he drunk dialed his best friend's wife, shit his pants, and passed out on the lawn. I recall that we made two separate trips to Walgreens for Pepto-Bismol the next day. For a while after the eyeball incident, Dennis had taken up redecorating the house, and against all odds, I found myself missing his demolition days, like when he tore the linoleum out of the kitchen and the time he helped himself to a jumbo bag of prunes from the pantry. This was only marginally less messy than when he drank a gallon of oil and yarfed up an Exxon Valdez-sized spill on the dining table. Now Dennis, like Big Jim, was in crisis. He missed Big Jim so much it was killing him. I got to work immediately, pushing pills as close to Big Jim as I could without him sampling my thighs. I attempted dive-bys, launching individual tablets into his mouth mid-air, but the all-important swallowing part never happened, and he just drooled out my precious pills in thick globs of blood. I launched heartworm chews and coffee and Snickers bars. I offered him old issues of Big Butts magazine and the photo of him with sunburnt knees when we caught the big Chinook salmon. Still nothing. I summer's eved the crap out of him, sifting the white powder all over his twisted joints and ganja-colored skin. None of it seemed to help. The sadness started to get to me, too. And listen, I'm an eternal optimist. Plucky is how I'm often described, and I won't argue with it. Big Jim says that I'm a smart aleck, too brainy for my own good, and a fucking opportunist. He grossly underestimated my love for coinage. I am well-read, have watched countless hours of educational and, thanks to Big Jim, reality television, and I tend to see the good in things. Generally, I believe the best is yet to come. But this was hard. A sadness crept under my skin like an army of termites, nibbling away at my resolve. At times, my heart felt like the fruit that shriveled and grew fur on the kitchen counter, bruised and rotting, fodder for flies. It made my legs feel heavy, made flight a chore. But while my sadness was temporary and healable, the makings of a scar, I knew, sure as I molt, that Dennis's was terminal. He was dying from sadness. So Yours truly embarked on two projects, Project Wellness and Project Happiness. I started using what I'd learned as a fledgling from Big Jim when he first took me into his home, when the treat training was so successful that I began to resemble a monster truck tire and he had to mitigate the rate of reward. But Dennis's hunger strike was legitimate. Even when I brought him kibble, piece by piece, he wouldn't leave the laundry room or Big Jim's rancid skivvies. So I was forced to bring in the big guns. Cheetos, those delectable radioactive poofs. Using my beak, I broke them into small chunks and placed a piece just out of Dennis's reach. I watched his spongy nose twitch and a forehead fold lift to expose an inquisitive eye. He sniffed again and unrolled a carpet of pink tongue to lasso the Cheeto. As Big Jim had done when I was a chick, I placed the Cheeto lures just out of Dennis's sight. At first, I got more sniffs. Then a twitch of the paw. Then, eureka! I got a tail wag. Finally, Dennis lifted his hulking mass of skin off the butt huggers, drove his snuffer to the ground, and snarfed up my lures like a champ. I thought about the Cymbalta commercial. Since I didn't have any Cymbalta and wasn't willing to risk another foray to Walgreens, for your info, none of the medications there work anyway. They did diddly jack for Big Jim. I thought about what the people and the dog that looks like a homeless Sammy Hagar were doing in the commercial. They were frolicking. That's exactly what Dennis needed. A frolic. Exercise. So I implemented playtime, where I'd yank his tail and he'd chase me across the yard. I cached Cheetos and Funyuns and kibble and beef jerky and chunks of Hungry Man frozen dinners around the house and yard, watching Dennis and his uncanny schnoz track down every last morsel. Against all odds, I enjoyed it. I worked on perfecting my whistle and replicating how Big Jim called for Dennis. "Dennis, here, boy," rewarding Dennis for answering my calls. I practiced the words in my best Big Jim from the back of my throat. "Dennis, sit!" And marveled as Dennis parked his keister on the grass below my branch, waiting for me to toss him a bright yellow peep. And would you believe it? The old Dennis started to come back. There he was with his rudder of a tail, plodding perkiness, that lumbering bloodhound bulk with more wrinkles than a cat's ass, and dare I say it, when I mimicked Big Jim's throaty calls of, "Good boy!" I even saw Dennis smile, puffing clouds of salmon jerky into the night air. I like to think he believed I was just like Big Jim, that I was a mofo. When I wasn't working on Dennis's disposition for Project Happiness, I was in the basement spitting pills down Big Jim's gullet. How long did this go on for? Can't say for sure. I've never fully grasped the concept of time, but I can tell you that I tried to follow Big Jim's Big Boobs Hot German Girls calendar and that we got through 1 month, two whole German boobs. I know what you're thinking. Why didn't I leave our home, fly out beyond our Ravenna neighborhood in search of help and medical assistance? Your question is valid and only slightly annoying. I made a choice, you see. I chose to stay close to Big Jim and keep to the nest because of the noises. During our forays into the yard, Dennis and I would hear sounds. Sounds that were like fireworks and gunfire, but louder. For a time, the sky was empty of birds, like during war or the 4th of July. We heard haunting shrieks we'd never heard before. Worst of all, we heard screaming. One evening, a crane fly, all gangly legs and drunken flight, landed on top of our fence. After catching his breath and stabilizing the quiver in his diaphanous wings, he called out to me. "Stay inside," he warned in a voice like the brittle rubbing of sticks. I ignored him as I'd always ignored insects and the constant babble of aura. "Listen! Listen! Gubari says you must stay inside." My skin pebbled into hard bumps. Gubari? Gubari knew I didn't listen to aura. He had sent a warning anyway. I trusted Gubari. It was enough for me. Dennis and I both now knew something very big was happening, and I wasn't willing to throw us into whatever it was that ripped apart a silent night toward whatever it was that snapped an evergreen in half. Call me naive or a coward, and I'll show you a crow who is here to tell you the goddamn story. After all, the best way is always to look out for numero uno. Despite my efforts, Big Jim stayed in the basement, wearing down much of his arm against the concrete wall while smelling like a keg of sautéed cat pee. But whenever I started to feel sorry for myself, I thought of Triscuits. In the middle of our Project Happiness month, the first tenacious buds began to kiss the air around them, and the strange sounds finally stopped. Dennis and I celebrated by spending more time in the yard, chasing one another, and working very hard at our happiness. Dennis even chased off taunting college crows and the salacious squirrels intent on teabagging the garden gnome. Some nights, Dennis would run to the fence, barking himself into a slobbering frenzy, smacking the panic button. As he'd raise his rubbery lips to the sky to let out a hound's bellow, I'd summon him inside.
"Dennis, come inside and have a Twinkie."
It was my best attempt at instilling a sense of preservation in Dennis, and I'd lecture him from Big Jim's armchair about how, in order to better one's survival odds, one should never be a hero, while he lay on the couch and licked his peeper. Confession time. I stored the Twinkie pieces in the cookie jar and may or may have not accidentally treated Dennis to Big Jim's eyeball. I have apologized to Big Jim profusely, but honestly, he doesn't seem to miss it. Anyway, mea culpa. Dennis's kibble ran out, but thanks to Big Jim's ursine appetite and predilection for a bargain, there were enough pantry staples to keep Dennis's heart afloat and his bowels permanently volcanic. This meant that I got to stay close to my nest and, apart from the odd recon flight, steer clear of the great unknown, of predators and mice, and the den of horror that is Walgreens. And then, one morning, I found Big Jim's cell phone. I was hunting for Dennis's Kong and discovered it underneath Big Jim's camouflage duvet bed, where he must have left it before the eyeball incident. A rush buzzed through me. Big Jim's cell phone! This would surely perk him up. He loved that thing. Yes! An opportunity to call for help. 911! I pressed on the power button, and miraculously, the cell phone lit up, bright screen aglow with a welcoming chirp, a chiming melody. And then hell broke from its fucking chains again. An unearthly scream ripped through the house. Dennis hit the panic button, coughing out distress in booming barks. The scream stopped. Breakneck crashing of footsteps shook the house. Big Jim was fucking leaving the basement. The footsteps thundered up the stairs at lightning pace, full tilt, and I knew, a Corvus knowing, he was coming straight for me. My eyes darted around his bedroom, looking for somewhere to hide. Half-open closet? Drawer of the clothing cupboard? Could I open the ammo trunk? No, he'd find me. The phone chimed again, fucking software update alert, and the house filled up with a dreadful, skull-splintering scream. My God, where was Dennis? Where did I see him last? Where did I leave him? I thought of Triscuits and shook my head, trying to use up the last few seconds before sick Big Jim found me. I had to keep the phone. It was my only hope, a chance to help Big Jim. Furious footsteps shook the ground. Think, ST, think! Snatching the phone in my beak, I launched into the air and flew to the bedroom window. Shut! I slammed into it, bashing my wing and the phone, slick in my beak, feeling it slip and plummet to the carpet. Focus! Window! Still shut! I dove for the phone, and suddenly Big Jim was in the doorway, more alive and not alive than I'd seen him in a long, long time. His neck was outstretched, craned unnaturally forward in that starving vulture way. I flashed back to the Walgreens mofos and gagged. Big Jim's eye was glowing red, wide, and lasered on my beak. A thick bone crack sounded out, and his lower jaw released, flapping down and hanging by a thin strip of gum, freeing a river of red. He shook his head, his jaw flapping loose, white pearl sliver of bone exposed. Blood streaked the walls. I clasped the phone tight as I could and flapped in the air, wing throbbing as I held my space. Big Jim let out a guttural roar and charged, the twisted fingers of his remaining hand extended like hawkbill knives. He pounded toward me, baring his yellowed teeth, cavernous jaw like an unspeakable red cave. inches away from my feathers. So close, my head spun from the wormy stench that was Big Jim as I ducked under his armpit and blasted through the bedroom door, diving down the stairs and toward the laundry room. Dennis stood his ground in the living room, hackles bristling like blades, barking sharp and fast. I yelled a muffled, "Dennis, sit!" as loud as I could, praying I'd done the work to save his life. Big Jim's pounding footsteps stirred the air near my tail feathers. I felt him right behind me, on me, felt his breath and his snarls seconds from yanking me from the air, shoving me into that terrible, terrible sanguine cavity. I tore through the laundry room, dropping the phone like a sun-baked stone. I shot bullet fast from the tiny exit window, scraping my head on the window frame. Big Jim unleashed a raptor's scream into the yard through the tiny window and bashed his head against its frame. I swung back around, re-entering the house by shooting through the kitchen window. I careened past Dennis, who barked frantically from a solid sit. Then I rocketed like a speeding black torpedo into the door with everything I had. The door slammed shut. Everything fell silent. No sounds came from the laundry room with the phone and what was left of Big Jim. Dennis panted silently, his legs aquiver. Nothing more was said. I couldn't go on pretending that nothing had happened, and I couldn't lock the laundry room door, which meant we were no longer safe in our own home. I just couldn't fix Big Jim alone. With nothing but the whoosh of wing, I gingerly plucked Dennis's leash from the wall and, pinching the mechanism with my beak, affixed it to his collar. Grabbing the looped handle in my feet, I lifted into the air and flew forward, Dennis plodding beneath me. Dennis pushed through the rickety back door and our gate in silence, past the Japanese maple where I first learned to fly, and we made our way along the sidewalk and the cement, abandoning everything we'd ever known and loved. We left slowly to the gentle song of lugubrious paw pads and the viscous beat of crestfallen wings, away from our home and our hearts. It was time. Time to face the terrifying unknown. Time we had answers. And I knew who we needed to hunt down. Chapter 6. ST. Outside the small craftsman home in Ravenna, Seattle, Washington, USA. So there we were, a rejected crow with an identity crisis partnering a bloodhound with the IQ of boiled pudding. We were perhaps the most pathetic excuse for an attempted murder on the face of the earth. Here we were, launching ourselves into a world we'd never known, one that had new teeth and no edges and a recent and significant overhaul. I led Dennis along the sidewalk, passing dead traffic lights, Nargatha's fairy tale house, and the yard with the now dusty swing set, releasing an involuntary cackle as I realized I was following cultural norms that may not apply anymore. With no cars in sight, we didn't need to look left or right while crossing the road or halt at stop signs, but I did it anyway because that's how I was raised. And I had to hold on to something other than the leathery loop of Dennis's leash. The gutters choked on trash that blanketed the sidewalks. It had baked and cooled, leaving the air pregnant with saccharine decay. Obviously, the garbage-collecting mofos had been at the NyQuil. When Big Jim took NyQuil, he slept through all four of his alarms, and I'd have to wake him by pelting beer bottle caps at his head. Big Jim. The trauma of nearly being eaten by my best friend was the single greatest pain I had ever known. It felt as though a sword had twisted itself through my papery skin. I now had learned the pain of betrayal, a pain that changes your very cells, writing itself into your DNA. All around us, the grass was tall, wicked weeds spiraling and impish, nature's barbed wire. If things were hiding in its chaos, they chose to remain invisible. Every few flaps, my feathers shivered with uncertainty. Dennis seemed keen to be outside again, preoccupied with his nasal adventures, trailing his spongy black whiffer along the ground, pendulous wrinkles swinging from side to side. He had a lot to catch up on. Now and then I tentatively dropped the leash and soared above to do recon, checking out what lay directly ahead of us, looking for the dark outline of a predator, looking for signs of twisted limbs, hungry vermilion eyes, and neck bones with no rules. looking for the healthy mofos I knew were out there, and most of all, listening. I reluctantly tuned in to Aura, listening to the boastful hoarding stories of a magpie. A Townsend's warbler couple fretted about whether the eagle would return. Black-capped chickadees warned of a large troop of hollows clustered around a shop called Scarecrow Video. Hollows are what most fauna have long called mofos, named for their dissociative state. In the natural world, mofos are mistaken for milky-eyed machines intent on destruction, empty vessels that have lost their inner intelligence, the walking blind, dumb animals. What utter blasphemy! A pie in the face of the species that invented a magic box that can nuke a hot pocket in seconds. Pigeons bickered about personal space. A red-breasted nuthatch sang a song about digestive health, chuckling to himself between breaths. There was excited twitter about the one who opens doors. And then, through Aura, I heard the greatest news of the century. The description came as news of distant explosions fighting one another, bang against bang, described as a war of bombs, and then my veins flooded with adrenaline because I knew there was only one species who'd mastered the art of obliterating things, of puppeteering weapons to do their bidding, the bureaucratic art of war. Mofos. I knew it. Healthy ones that could drive a tank and release a nuke. Somewhere they were out there, fighting back, gaining ground, and reclaiming their territory, which meant that somewhere, someone in a lab coat was working on a cure. My heart soared. I listened more, puffed with happiness. I could hear crows calling to one another, sharing information about caches and spreading valuable intel about food stops. I listened for as long as I could handle, waiting for specifics about the heroic survivor mofos, but the pressing topic never returned. And it was exhausting getting bombarded with a constant butt-splosion of information. I told Dennis to sit under the shade of a newly budding Japanese cherry tree, launching into the air for more recon. I perched on the moss-green roof of the university public library. Smoke rose in black coils from the horizon far in the distance, too far to be of immediate concern. I had a clear view of the library's surrounding area. Eye to eye with the tree line, I peered down at parking lots and a patchwork of slate-gray rooftops. Not far away, the spire of the Blessed Sacrament Church caught the sun with its glacial green. I cleared my throat, stomach suddenly twisting into pretzel shapes. I spread my wings, opened my beak, and fluttered my gular. This sounds ruder than it is. It's actually just me flapping my neck muscles to stay cool. The burnt matchsticks that are my legs started to shake. Yep, I was a fellow with stage fright. But Dennis and I had plans, and I needed information desperately. So I took in a deep breath, ruffled my plumage, and called out to a world I've never been a part of, the natural world. Can someone tell me how to find Onita? Please, I'm looking for Onita, the one searched for. Silence. I waited a minute and then decided to try again, calling out louder with a sprinkle more bravado, a touch more bass in my tone. The silence became eerie. The symphony of Aura ceased. A gust of wind blew through the tree crowns, rustling the branches of the cherry trees. The trees whispered the words of a sharp-edged warning. Beware. Beware. I wished they were more specific. I looked down to check on Dennis, who was lying under the tree, sniffing at the sky. Something did feel off. I felt like there were eyes on me. Not literally like when I cached Big Jim's eyeball, but like someone or something was watching me in the shadows. I tried one more time to get my post into Aura, donning a bit of an accent this time, a little soap opera flair to my delivery.
Please, it is a matter of life and death. I must unearth Onita.
There was no response. More breathless silence. Just then, an Anna's hummingbird darted past me, a bullet in mother of pearl, who shrieked, Cheese cups! Ass clubs! Keep away! Hummingbirds have a reputation for being curt and vague, but I began to wonder if this one had been at some fermented fruit. Turns out, I didn't have to wait long to decipher her warning. The big black doors at the top of the stone steps to the building of books swung open. under the arches of the great white structure, under ivory pillars and large green letters bearing the library's name, loomed an enormous mass. It let out a deep huff, a low grumble that made the earth tremor. It squinted to orient itself in the bright sunlight. A fucking grizzly. My eyes locked in on the Japanese cherry tree, below it to Dennis, now standing on four paws, body posture tense and erect, and facing the great tawny mass that had emerged from the library. Cheese and shit niblets, Dennis, don't make a fucking sound! On cue, Dennis let out a burst of booming barks that seemed to say, "Fuck off, you douche flute," which is exactly what a grizzly the size of a jumbo vending machine likes to hear after rousing from a nap. The bear spun toward Dennis. Even from this distance, I could see a ripple streak through the copper tips of its fur. It rose to its hind legs and started huffing, the silence clouded with guttural growls. Dennis responded by barking louder, faster, spinning on his axis. The bear moaned, a long, pointed accusation, huffed harder, stopped to sniff the air. Then it flattened its ears to its head and expelled a roar that tore through the bones of the building and ran up my spine. Long, mustard-brown fangs were all I needed to see. The bear coughed out more woofs, panting frustration. It slapped the stone ground with its club-like paws, which was grizzly language I understood. It was going to kill Dennis. The bear reared back and charged at Dennis full tilt. I cried out to him. The mass of muscle and brown stopped just before reaching Dennis's front paws, lifting its head high into the air, lowering it to train its eyes on him. It lunged at him with open mouth and mammoth paws in flight, great black nose twitching. Dennis barked, darting from side to side to avoid the swipes, saliva frothing on his jowls. The bear began to circle Dennis, backing him up against the Japanese cherry tree. I didn't have much time. Think, ST, think. I dropped from the library roof, conserving my energy by hijacking a ride on a puff of air. Beak first, I made a beeline for the grizzly's head. As I neared, I filled with smell, the smell of clover, wet grass, raw liver, putrid carcass. Then, right as I neared Dennis's tail, the bear threw its weight into a paw swipe. The blow smashed Dennis across his ribs, sending him rolling across the library lawn. He yelped, a string of tight squeals that I heard in my heart. Dennis! I slipped past the bear's right ear, maneuvered a tight midair flip turn, and drove my beak into the bear's backside. The bear lifted its teeth skyward and bellowed at the sun. Pivoting on hind legs, it lunged at me fang first, missing my wing by an inch. I rose above the bear, snatching its ear in my foot and yanking hard. The bear whipped its paw up, driving a force of air that thrust me sideways. I recovered, lifting to safety. Still on hind legs, the grizzly woofed and huffed at me, rage igniting amber in its eyes. I stole a glance at Dennis. He was back on all paws, shaking off the hit, steadying, and no doubt preparing to put himself back into the jaws of an adult bear. I was too focused on Dennis. The bear smashed me midair, giant club of a paw punching me through space and time and into the trunk of the Japanese cherry tree. I hit the tree with a thwack and toppled to the dirt, completely winded. A sharp pain streaked up my beak. Fluttering my gular, I righted myself at the tree base to see the bear lumbering toward Dennis. My eyes darted. Come on, ST, do something! Snapping up a huge silvery rock the size of a whole German boob in my feet, I soared high, high up into the air, wings burning from the sun and sting, and I released that fucking boob rock like a World War II B-24 dropping its load. The rock struck the grizzly's skull with a dull clonk. I might as well have kicked it in the nuts. The bear got very, very angry. It lunged at me from below, roaring from its pancreas, arms swinging, mustard fangs snapping at my back. I fluttered above it for a few seconds, air dodging the blows, my wing burning with a stirring ache. I counted one, two, three, then whisked over the bear's head and shot right over Dennis.
"Dennis, here, boy," I screeched.
I heard Dennis's frantic panting under my tail feathers as I dove over the library lawn, my shadow a phantom below. Crow chased by bloodhound, chased by grizzly bear, across the university public library entrance lawn and across the street, and then tearing across the stretch of green that's the university playground. Never in my life have I ever been happy to see a Honda Civic, but today was a day of firsts, and I dove beneath its undercarriage, beneath its royal blue body, whistling for Dennis. Dennis skidded into the Civic's passenger door, then stuffed his wrinkled mass under the car with me, where we waited for an enraged apex predator to exact its revenge. In an instant, the air was filled with calls, screams, threats, warnings, made a deafeningly horrid symphony. I peeked out from behind a rear tire to see the sky inky with bodies, all of them hovering above the air, flapping and cawing and pelting rocks and bottle caps and shoes and Gatorade and condoms at the stunned bear. The bear snarled and swiped, but quickly realized it was outnumbered as the crows intensified their attack, caws getting louder and louder. Suddenly, the bear lowered its head, shook its fur, and cantered back toward the black library doors, a sky full of black demons driving it on.
"Enough!"
screamed someone with the voice of God or James Earl Jones. And the crows stopped. Quiet trapped us in its net. You could have heard a mouse fart. They retreated, disappearing into the trees. I looked over at Dennis, who was licking his side vigorously. A flap of skin hung down from his ribs where the grizzly had clobbered him. I inched out from under the Honda and lifted myself high enough into the air to see the grizzly back at the library doors. Flashbacks from the Discovery Channel haunted me, stirring up the Latin name for the grizzly bear, Ursus Arctos Horribilis. Horribilis indeed. As the bear paced and then started to lumber away from the library, three brown blobs emerged from the doors to shadow her. Cubs. Great. She reproduced. There are more of those fuzzy death potatoes out in society, helping themselves to public facilities that are funded by our hard-earned tax dollars. My mind belatedly translated the hummingbird's cry of, "Cheese cups, ass clubs, keep away," to the more plausible, "She's up, has cubs, keep away." I'll admit, I had been a bit quick to judge her sobriety. I lowered to terra firma and watched Dennis licking and whining at the angry gash in his side. Puttering along the curb where the Honda was parked, I located a brightly colored flyer for the High Times U.S. Cannabis Cup in Seattle, Washington. Snatching it in my beak, I hopped back to the Civic and whistled, summoning Dennis to inch himself from the car's comatose body. I plodded toward him and gingerly pressed the High Times flyer to his side. He snapped instinctually, and I sprang backward.
"Easy, Dennis. Easy, boy," I said,
mimicking Big Jim every time he loaded Dennis into the bathtub as I hopped onto the sink to avoid a tidal wave of water. Big Jim was always too busy wrestling the hound and camouflaging the bathroom in soap suds to listen to me explain Dennis's predicament. It wasn't the bath Dennis was afraid of. It was the plug hole. He was afraid he would get sucked down into the dark and we wouldn't find him. Dennis was on to something. I once cashed the house key down there, and it was never seen again. Dennis let out a tight growl.
"Good boy, Dennis. It's okay. I gotcha,"
I whispered, shuffling toward him. Pain was licking up my wing in electric streaks, and my injury wasn't half as bad as Dennis's. Other than a sharp whine, he didn't protest anymore, seeming to trust me, to accept my medical assistance. The prismatic cannabis cup flyer stuck fast to his wet wound.
"Brother Blackwing," came the imposing voice. I grimaced.
Both titles bothered me. I don't fully identify as a crow, finding the label to be overly simplistic. And I was not his brother. A constellation of shining black eyes tracked me from the big leaf maples above. College crows. Dennis seemed too distracted by his pain to care. The maples themselves watched silently, gently breathing in some of the tension. Trees are known peacekeepers, though not very good with secrets. I kept quiet, unsure of what to say or whether I wanted to say anything at all. Dennis and I were outnumbered, weak, and exposed. I waited, resisting the temptation to Gular flutter so as not to give away my emotional state.
"Blackwing," the voice continued,
this time like the chiming of cathedral bells, as a large black corvid dropped from the sun and onto a low maple arm. I cocked my head at him, hopping onto one foot. He craned forward, the brilliant blue of his sheen lulling me into a false sense of comfort. You might think we all look alike, but again, it just takes a bit of focus, attention, consciousness. Mofos tend to be too locked in the beautiful basements of their minds to notice certain subtleties. "Sorry, I said I'd be honest. No, this wasn't your run-of-the-mill trash raider. This was a bold and charismatic presence with a perfectly polished charcoal beak. I saw his game. This sneakster was out to disarm me with charm."
"Are you all right, Brother Blackwing?"
"We are fine, and I'm not your brother," I answered. The beautiful crow bobbed his head, a submissive offering.
"We see that you have command over the dog."
Ah, there it is, I thought. An angle. Big Jim says there's always an agenda. That's why you've got to batten down the hatches, fight for what's yours, and look out for numero uno. That's why you don't let anyone in. Big Jim's philosophy, sound and clear as Windexed glass. Everyone wants to steal your Cheetos. I refused to answer the crow, keeping burning questions about what had happened to the mofos in my plumage. I would seek answers from a trustworthy source.
"He's hurt,"
said the annoyingly flawless Fancy of Feathers, whose wings looked like something out of Da Vinci's sketchbook.
"Here."
Another crow, smaller with a burn patch on the underside of her right wing and singed contour feathers, dropped from above. She released a petite bushel of herbs at my feet. The boss crow gestured,
"Yarrow, for the dog. It will help with healing."
Dennis didn't like me approaching the cannabis cup flyer, his hide erupting in a shudder of flinches, but he allowed me to peel it from the wet red and press the yarrow against his wound with my feet as the crow crowd looked on in awe. A sense of importance warmed my throat like Woodenville whiskey. The Prince of Perfect started up again.
"You need to be careful out here."
"We don't need your help," I spat, surprised by my venom.
"You are the one who called for help on Aura,"
said the crow, his legions gently chirruping in agreement.
"We didn't know you knew about Aura or the ways of the Blackwings. We've watched you for some time now."
"Yeah, watched, harassed, threatened. Nice job, guys," I said, adding more of the stalks and miniature white flowers of the yarrow to Dennis's red, red hole. "Listen, I thank you for chasing off the grizzly, truly, but Dennis and I are doing just fine by ourselves." Main Crow fluttered his wings, his head darting from side to side, displaying his displeasure to the black bodies around him.
"I will apologize for any misgivings. I am sorry to hear of them. Perhaps I can help you."
"I need to find Oneida."
"Oneida?"
Suddenly the crows were statues as the wind exhaled through the maple tree, its leaves dancing like a 1920s flapper.
"Oneida,"
it whispered,
"the one searched for."
The crows waited, monuments of reverence, for the secrets to take the wings of the wind.
"Oneida, how do you know of Oneida?"
asked the crow chief, his nictitating membrane licking his eye.
"Oneida," came a crow's voice from a collage of emerald leaves. "The one who moves between worlds. The one of many names. The one of the stars," cried another.
"The sayer of truths. The master of escape."
"Oneida, the one of many minds."
"How do you know of Oneida?"
the beautiful crow asked again.
"Oneida can only be found if Oneida wants to be. Oneida is everywhere and nowhere, and knows tomorrow's sun. If Oneida calls, you are summoned like tides by the moon."
I would never tell them that I might have accidentally tuned in to their unavoidably noisy-ass aura a couple of times in the past, where I might have heard about the one searched for, this so-called prophet, by mistake.
I would never tell them that I was so desperate and in need of answers that I'd do anything, even follow the directive whisperings of Aura to help my Big Jim. Respectfully, that's not your business. And I definitely wouldn't tell those ass trumpets. I bobbed my head at Bonnie and Clyde, my two regular harassers. He gave them both a dark stare.
I see. Well, if you'd be willing...
I don't think they'd be willing to associate with a hybrid like me.
But you are a hybrid, aren't you? A hybrid Blackwing, enslaved by the mofos, caged and clipped.
Clipped? My wings work perfectly. Probably better than yours.
We aren't judging you, Blackwing. We say how it is. My name is Cry.
This is my best attempt to phonetically translate his name for you. Look, Cry, don't call me hybrid or Blackwing. My name is Shitturd, and I am what I am. Just tell me where I can find Onida, please, and we'll be on our way.
Since you are a hybrid Blackwing, you walk the way of the Hollows. You live trapped in a...
Enough! I squawked, mimicking his earlier cry. You don't know who I am. None of you fuckers do. This caused a frenzy among the crows, a bluster of throaty keening. I reeled, backing up and bracing myself. Dennis sprang to his feet, racing to the trunk of the tree and unleashing his warnings at the maple full of life. I'd only ever seen the dreaded UPS trucks inflame him in this manner. I beamed, my breast feathers puffing to inflate me. I had my own protector, my own murder. Cry silenced his brethren with one slash of his beak cutting through the air. He took his time with a slow nod, and then he gave me directions. I'm afraid I'm not able to precisely translate these for you. I don't mean to sound patronizing, but if you haven't been airborne, you have no context, and the translation is complicated. I will try to simplify it for you. Basically, the sky is a bird's nature, home, an extension of the soul. They know it and remember it better than earthly destinations. Feathered ones, except penguins and turkeys because they're fucking morons, have wonderful memories. Not sure why elephants get all the damn credit. They travel by tips heard through Aura, sort of like GPS, and by their relationship to the sun and stars who engage them in a sensory conversation. All this forms what we call a mind map. Conversations with no words are understandably very difficult to explain to mofos, but they are happening all the time, all around. The hardest part to explain is the Earth's magnetic field, which can always be heard, much like Aura. Think of it as the strings of a McPherson Camriel 4.0 acoustic guitar in your heart, the strumming of which gives you insight and instruction. All flora and fauna listen to the Earth's magnetism. It is how the sand, soil, clay, and dust communicate, how every element of our infinite universe and shared home talks to us, sometimes guiding us through our journey. I guess the closest mofo comparison is how your gods speak to some of you, or the emergency broadcast system. We perceive ultraviolet light and wavelengths of color that allow us to see sexual dichromatism, which is how I could tell, aside from looking up her skirt, that the petite crow with the burn patch under her right wing was a girl. UV light paints a kaleidoscope of patterns and signals that mofos appear to be blind to. A literal blindness, different from the commonplace numbed blindness of closing off the mind. I think it would just be fucking rude of me to harp on about what beauty and insight you're missing out on there. So, mind maps. I guess I could tap into all this majestic shit more often, but I'll be honest, I use landmarks like Starbucks, the Space Needle, and McDonald's. Way more practical and iconic. Cry and the college Blackwings watched us leave. A pair of cabbage-white butterflies danced around me, pirouetting in the sunshine. Butterflies live short lives because they have mastered the art of living. They serve to pass it on with luminous bursts of joy, bright flickers from the other side. I listened to their bell-like beckoning.
Onida calls you! Onida calls you!
They uttered, breathless with excitement. The paper-winged ones are truth-tellers, postage-stamp-sized messengers who paint the air into a watercolor of magic and taste with their feet. We are best advised not to blast them with Roundup. Knowing I had a fairly decent audience at this point, I decided to ham up my exit by sitting on Dennis's back while holding his leash in my foot, riding him like a stallion into the Wild West. I could hear chirps and incredulous murmurs all around. It was pretty freaking awesome. Well, it would have been had I not been more scared than a KFC-bound chicken. There was a corn nut of truth in what Cry said. I was, after all, clipped, a crow who'd never really left his own nest. And Oneida was far from home, and the West was wilder than I could have possibly imagined. Chapter 7. Bayonsan Bando National Park, just north of Hanbit Nuclear Power Plant, South Korea, as dictated by a young fairy, Pita.
We are airborne. Quick, quick, quick. Dart through the branches. Call out, run, run. No time to dilly-dally. Below the tree crowns, 1,000 feet drum. Tiki, 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 tiki. Martin, weasel, badger. They run in black and white and brown. Hare leaps. Go, go, go. Legs hope to fly. Snake and salamander run. Squiggly limbs and slippery belly. Moth and butterfly knew first. They are ahead. They felt it coming before it knew itself. They knew it in the wise of them. The air is busy with duck and goose and Baikal teal and tiger shrike. Flying squirrel glides like quick leaves. We woke to a new smell in the air, sharp as a hawk's beak. Now we run. The message came from Echo on the waves that preen sand near where the heat is rising. The rising hot comes from big buildings that look like a line of eggs. They are from the nests of hollows. We must fly as fast as we can before the eggs crack. I dart between trees. My family is a whirl of color through the tips of branches. Quick, quick, quick! Below us, cats with rangy legs skitter-scatter. Mice run alongside them, a bigger danger on their earthworm tails. I flit past crested ibis, beaky blur of white and pink, who says, "Faster! It's coming!" We know it's coming. We feel it. It's a prickle on the beak, a soon sneeze. We hear it. We run for high ground. The trees hum and sing to one another, breathing love and story. They cannot run. Thin screams come. Fox shrieks below. Quick, quick, quick! Before the eggs crack, before the waves swell with anger, before the orange hot licks up the land. Quick, quick, quick! I feel it now. The rumbling starts.
Chapter 8. ST. University Branch, the Seattle Public Library, Seattle, Washington, USA. Dennis seemed to have perked up after the Yarrow application. I admitted to myself that it was a better remedy than my weed competition flyer and had to eat a little crow, if you'll pardon the expression. Hey, in my defense, everything I learned about veterinary care was from Animal Planet, and they didn't tend to get overly technical on breed all about it. We headed south, following Cry's directions. I used the snaking gray river of I-5 as my guide, soaring above to check our immediate vicinity. Dennis had no qualms about me riding him now and then, as long as he got to catch up on his P-mail and work toward his unwavering goal of watering every grass blade in the Pacific Northwest. I-5 South was a ghost of itself, missing its pulse, the touch and droning hum of wheels. Cars were strewn around it, silent and sleeping. Some had crashed into one another, bodies black and crumpled with dents. I wrapped my beak on the rear windshield of a mud-splattered minivan, tapping on the superhero's decal. Dad's superhero, Mom's superhero, and three little superheroes, even a superhero dog, all with capes and smiles and arms punching the air in victory. Other than a Pokemon toy, there was no trace of them in the van, but I had a good feeling about them because superheroes can survive anything. I saw Superman stop a bullet with his iris one time. I dropped Earthbound to check for survivors intermittently, finding evidence of horror movie endings in the form of sparkling shards or in a mofo's lonely bones and the tenacious blue and green skin that clung to them. And everywhere, that greedy reek of rotting meat haunting the air like a ghoul that grabs at your tongue. Many mofos had perished there in their vehicles, their destinations waiting forever. I thought of their families and felt a pang of gratitude that Big Jim was still mostly alive. My recon safety checks were frequent, but cursory, since I didn't like to leave Dennis for long. From the sky, I could recognize clusters of sick mofos, their humped backs and snapping turtle necks, scraping with their fingers, smashing their heads against medians and trucks and fallen motorbikes. We took detours where there were sick mofos. My keen eyes hunted for uprightness, the miraculously vertical, straight-backed glory and the steady gait that exemplify a healthy mofo. I knew they were out there. Hope flickered like a tiny pilot light inside me, keeping dark thoughts at bay. I thought of the frolicking in the Cymbalta commercial and knew we had to keep moving. A freeway sign caught my eye. It had been brightened with lightly faded graffiti, an intricate scene that had the runny, bubbled words, "Born to be wild," over a realistic picture of a lion licking an ice cream cone. Instead of a ball of ice cream, the cone held a grenade. Anarchy or art, those mofos certainly were creative. The doomed African king was surrounded by rudimentary scribbles. One said, "Rather not be human." Another, "Kurt Cobain, forever." Another scrawl said, "The four horsemen are here. They came on the wings of a breeze." Ridiculous. Horses are way too heavy for that shit. With every step Dennis and I took, there was palpable agitation, airborne collywobbles clouding the air. Even the sun peeked through the clouds cautiously, unsure and perhaps afraid of what she might illuminate in the broken city below. A swift flight to the west allowed me to hover over Gasworks Park on the north shore of Lake Union. From my bird's eye view, the park was almost unrecognizable. Big Jim says that most things can be fixed with duct tape, but staring at the changed park, I was dubious. At some point, a Boeing 747 had tumbled from the clouds and collided with the red skeleton of the old gasification plant, birthing a mangled mess of aluminum and demolition and bloody rust. Bobbing gently in Lake Union yards away, the tail and blades of a King V helicopter peeked out from above the waterline. The park's beautiful sundial, centrally located on a grassy hill which allows a flightless mofo to enjoy Seattle's skyline, was charred and burnt, its face forever scarred. Black bruises kissed the park where small fires had erupted. A couple of skeletons, big and small, cowered under a picnic table. Then a flurry caught my eye. A ghoulish gaggle of vulture-necked mofos were huddled in a mass by the park's concrete arches, the gray ghosts of old train trestles. Mofos crawled over one another, a living tumor of blood and tissue. I couldn't see what they were scrambling for, what was at the epicenter of this pile-up of doom, but knew better than to get close. No, the healthy mofos weren't in Gasworks Park. They'd found shelter elsewhere. Sadness tugged at my tail feathers. Although whatever had taken over Big Jim had obviously hit my neighborhood the worst, it had spread farther than I thought, desecrating my home city and its gorgeously iconic bits. In Lake Union, boats bobbed aimlessly, sails lying flat against the water like soaked surrender flags. The sky was painfully silent without the brassy blare of brightly colored seaplanes overhead. Everything felt too quiet, like held breath. This was no longer the fastest-growing city in America. This was a battleground, a war zone. And yet, on the far side of the park, I saw deer grazing on the dense, jungly grass that grew everywhere, stretching their necks to reach the vines and creepers that hung down from tree crowns. I told Dennis we should get a move on, and we made our way farther down the phantom of I-5, stopping to fill ourselves with blackberries and salmon berries from the brambles that threatened to swallow part of the freeway alive. A section of the road was flooded, forcing Dennis to paddle through an algae lake as I hopped alongside him across the tops of vehicles, acting as his neurotic swim coach. Once across, I stared back at the freeway lake, marveling at the soupy devastation, while Dennis shook himself dry, releasing a halo of wet. I pillaged a small blanket from an abandoned SUV with punched-out windows, gingerly dabbing at Dennis's wound to dry it. I hopped in place, anxious to move on. I was stress-stuffed, a hot pocket of angst. Who knows what might have been lurking under that quiet film of green scum? A red-tailed hawk, talons tightly clutching at old habits, looped above the freeway, searching for roadkill. an extinct species. She started to follow us, but Dennis, full of piss and blackberries, told her where she could stick her razor-edged bill in strangled bugle howls. Dennis was really getting into this murder thing. Several street lamps later, we approached a gruesome scene. 7 colossal rib cages adorned with nubs of rotten meat sat on the freeway like a horrifying art installation. The road was stained deep red with blood and the slimy residue of entrails. Bovines. These were the foundations of what used to be some sort of cattle, picked almost clean by something. A bright rainbow suddenly streaked above us, almost too fast to register. A flock of colorful birds I couldn't identify or understand. So I was distracted, looking skyward, when a goat, skin stretched tight over bones, eyeballs bulging with the stress shits, shot past us, startling us. We both noticed the purple wound where his tail used to be. He didn't make a sound, skittering into the trees, gone before we could get answers. Very un-goat-like. He had survived something unspeakable, hooves propelled by survival instinct. Dennis sniffed at the bone sculptures and raised his head toward the bold front line of evergreen trees. He didn't need to convince me further. We picked up the pace from there, knowing that Seattle had seen a change of Mount Rainier proportions, and that whatever it was big and destructive and largely hidden from us. It was also safe to say at this point that I-5 South was officially the freeway of death. In all fairness, I've heard it described this way many times on the radio before, so not much change in that respect. Dennis and I followed the slippery eel of I-5 and listened to the trees. The moan of a madrone, the counsel of a Douglas fir, the shimmer of a cherry tree, the whine of a white-bark pine, paper birches, dogwoods, and oaks and maples and sweet gums and cedars and elms. Some shared memories of things that had occurred many, many years before on the land around their trunks. Slow stories of fights between lovers, the massacre during the lumber industry boom, the Great Seattle Fire, and the Klondike Gold Rush. Trees are super nostalgic. Others recited soothing poems in sotto voce, oral balms learned as seedlings. Some spoke of when the bison and the wolf roamed this land. They talked of change and whispered about a predestined event, repeating the word Renaissance in harmony. I had no clue what all this had to do with Michelangelo, but you don't argue with a tree. One thing was certain. They were full of beans, on fire with chitter-chatter. But, and I will swear on a Cheeto here, the Douglas firs were talking to me directly. This is as much a surprise to me as it is to you. This had never, ever happened before, least of all to me, a weirdo hybrid crow. Trees are normally very general and all-inclusive with their wisdom pearls. When a tree decides to talk to you, it's a very, very big deal, as if the world stops, as if you are scooped up and held in a snow globe, weightless and womb-like. I felt their vibrations in my feathers, in the flutter of my little black heart. The Douglas firs were all pointing. Each had one solitary branch outstretched, urging me toward my destination, down I-5, and to whatever lay ahead. To Oneida. As is polite and customary when spoken to by a tree, I answered back, calling out my thanks from above their towering tops. I followed humbly, pilot light rekindled, floppy skin bag bloodhound in tow. Intermittent mofo clusters, lone cobra-necked mofos, and Dennis not being a greyhound all added time to our journey south. To avoid mofos, we hid behind medians, construction sandbags, an ice cream truck with rancid lactose sludge smearing its insides, and an empty Lamborghini with the Seahawks logo blazoned all over it. But most mofos seemed to be exhibiting the same sort of repetitive behavior that Big Jim had. I couldn't figure them out. They were at once distracted and dangerous, disturbed, stuck and broken and yet somehow waiting for something. They smelled like hot garbage, not the delicious kind. When we finally neared our destination, I shot above to take in Seattle's Pike Place Market, a tourist mecca that includes the original Starbucks, a wall encrusted with chewed gum, and men who lob fish at one another. Pike Place Market, its iconic red sign unlit, was teeming with mofos, and my heart beat its wings in delight. Hallelujah! Praise IHOP! They'd all come here! They'd all traveled down I-5 South and taken refuge in the market, among the beautiful flower displays, waterfront views, and specialty teas that cost the same as a kidney. I lowered, preparing to let out a caw of jubilation, and then my stomach fizzed into boiling acid. The mofos were shoulder to shoulder, loping in a writhing mass, spewing from the underground of the market and through its souvenir-lined corridors, bumping into one another, trailing their fingers and bobbing their snapping turtle necks. Every single one of them had what Big Jim had. I can only technically count to 9, but it seemed like millions. No growling cars, just the remnants of long rotten fruit, rotten fish, rotten mofos, and onesies with the Space Needle painted on them. I gagged. How could this have happened? How could so many mofos be sick? I was getting woozy from hunger pangs and wing-wrenching dismay. A stand that called itself the Daily Dozen Donut Company caught my eye. I perched on top of one of the stand's last remaining shelves. The stand had taken a beating, its cash-only sign dangling like a severed limb. Stools lay on their sides, legless and splintered. Glass sparkled from the market floor. A body lay near a silver stand mixer that was fossilized by its own icing. It hadn't been dead long. The perpetrator would still be close. The eyes were frozen in terror, glazed with torture. Someone had ripped its white body into 2 parts, a bisection. Teeth marked its entrails, ruby-red blood stained paper-white feathers. Wonderful. Some of them were eating glaucous-winged gulls. I watched the pulsing mass of mofos as they swayed and lumbered. Some were stationary and dragging their fingers like Big Jim. Some stared into the middle distance as if reading something on the horizon. Others crept around face first, blood-red eyes bobbing like a pigeon's neck in search of something. One mofo stood next to a pile of donuts that had been knocked off a 3-tiered silver platter and lay next to a jar that said, "God knows when you don't tip." The mofo directly between me and a pile of delectable donuts was wallpapered with nautical tattoos. A slouchy beanie sat on his head, his beard mimicking a comatose beaver. The suspenders and bow tie weren't fooling me, though. I knew this mofo's game. His left hand was pressed to his ear, and you bet your ass I'd taken stock of that shock of bright red that dribbled down his plaid shirt. The glaucous-winged gull eater. On TV, I've learned that crows by nature can be pretty persistent. If you've ever pissed one off, you'll know this. I think it's coded, cocooned deep in the fluff of our down feathers to hold on to things, ideas, grudges, your engagement ring. There was no exception here. By the fumes of NASCAR, I was going to get a damned donut. A stealth swoop fueled by a growling stomach shot me past the glaucous-winged gull eater. He let out a high-pitched scream, a spleen-quivering skirl that caused the surrounding mofos to snap their necks toward him. Glaucous-winged gull-eater bit at me as I careened past him, just missing sinking his gull-stained choppers into my back. The mass of mofos let out a series of low-pitched moans, some sort of horrible summoning. Then rushed the glaucous-winged gull-eater. They ran forward, toward us, crushing the Daily Dozen Donut Company sign, the counter, the silver fryer, industrial cooking machinery, the trash can, everything in the herd's way. They charged forth, blood and saliva flying. Tubs of sugar hissed through the air. A blizzard of flour blew down hard. They brayed with jaws wide, emitting a sick song. A woman with black braids and a large, dripping hole in her midsection raced forward. A man with a broken guitar hanging from his back and plucked-out eyes roared as he ran, pushed forward by a sea of mofos led by an old lady with a knitted cat sweater and a face that looked like it had been sculpted from mashed potatoes. 2 small, identical mofos crawled on all fours, backs arched like quick cats, rippling with twitches and convulsions as they sprung forward, scampering up the other mofos, a breakneck clamber to get ahead. I dove from above, inches from their outstretched claws, snatching a donut in my beak and a bag of coffee beans with my feet. I shot myself airborne as the crowd smashed into Glaucus-winged Gull-Eater, trampling him, a mass of sickness and moans and devastation. Time to go. I flapped hard, soaring over Pike Place until the mofos were a formicary of moshing ants. A teeming swarm, soldiers trampling soldiers. I lifted high, high, high above the implosion and dropped a sizable bomb of my own as I emptied my bowels upon the wild beasts below. I had left Dennis at Waterfront Park near Pier 59, tucked behind the waterfront fountain, a cubicle structure that looks like interlocking bronze keys. The area was familiar to me, as Big Jim and I had come here once to install an underground electrical conduit. The fountain water no longer flowed. Instead, the still water was cloaked by a green algae veil. The fountain looked deeply sad without a purpose. Seattle now felt like this, as if it was choking under a thickening green skin. The partially demolished Alaskan Way viaduct had none of its usual elevated roar and rumble. Now it was suffocating under an emerald green curtain of English ivy and Parni Katonister. A ferocious growl ran up my spine. I pivoted to find Dennis hovering over a mass on Alaskan Way. I leapt into the air and to his side. Dennis rumbled with anger. Saliva dripped from his jowls, eye whites shining. The object of his aggression was a large, shiny lump, a ballooning buildup of tissue and blood. Slimy bubbles popped from its surface. The blob rose up and down methodically, as if it had a pulse. It jiggled like the filling of an uncooked pie, each wobble sending Dennis into madness. He puffed his cheeks, pursed his rubbery lips, and released growls that swelled into bold, trumpeting bellows.
Roar! Roar!
I don't know, buddy. I don't like it either, I told him. Dennis's loose skin flinched. His barrel chest heaved with the exertion of every howl. Starting to worry about his blood pressure, I lured Dennis with the donut away from the unknown thing that smelled like death and decay and molten iron. Weird lump out of sight, I had a little sample of the donut, which had aged nicely to the consistency of a truck tire. Delicious! 1,000 times better than the fried blobs Big Jim liked to get from 7-Eleven. He'd really been holding out on me. Probably because the Pike Place ones were too expensive. Big Jim hated that. Like that time he ordered a latte from Café Ladro. $5? And asked the barista when he should expect his accompanying testicle massage. A mofo wearing a manager badge and a monkfish face disinvited us from their establishment for eternity. Some mofos can be very obtuse. After I'd plucked off the mold and had a good sample of donut, I dropped it for Dennis, who chowed down happily. I'd say it was a testament to the quality and endurance of Daily Dozen Donuts, but here I must remind you that Dennis's favorite snack is a dehydrated bull penis. The bag of Vachon Dark Side of the Moon coffee beans burst open easily, cloaking me in comfort with an ambrosial cloud of roasted nose joy. Oh, those delightfully nutty little rabbit turds were a welcome sight. Finally, something familiar, something that made sense. I nibbled on the beans while Dennis cocked a leg and relieved himself in the fountain. We would soon lose light, and it was time to find who we'd come looking for. I rattled, a sound like I'd swallowed maracas, for Dennis to follow me to the doors, or what was left of them. The belly of the building was dark, a briny, ominous smell leaking from its bowels. A quick breeze ruffled my feathers, crow bumps forming on my skin. Dennis stopped once we reached the white framing that used to hold the glass entrance doors. He started to pace, swinging his pendulous head wrinkles from side to side. His paw touched some of the green water that bled from inside the building, and he whined. It was clear that I'd be flying solo here. "Don't be a nervous Nelly, Dennis. I'll be all right," I told him. Obviously, he actually had been listening to my lectures back home on not being a hero. I probably should have toned those down a little, as I can be very persuasive. Dennis let out a yodel of protest, sniffing vigorously at the air. He paced, prodded, and whimpered next to a plant making a tenacious evacuation from its pot under a broken metallic sign that now read, "Siat e aquarium." I told him to wait by the fountain again and flapped my wings erratically. He lifted his panicked, sad sap eyes to me and barked, a stentorian alarm. The message, low and laced with desperation, needed no translation. Don't go in there. The nerves were making my legs quiver. Probably should have had about 40 fewer coffee beans than what I'd just enjoyed. Swooping through the building's entrance frame, I was plunged into a damp darkness. The little light there streamed from gaping windows, the broken teeth of the building. A fetid stench, briny and billowing like an old wet animal, punched me in the dick. Technically, crows don't have dicks, but that doesn't make me less of a dude. I perched on top of the entrance counter below three burnt flat screens. Water, dark and murky as ink, submerged the aquarium's floor. A scan of the lobby revealed a cinema screen-sized aquarium with its glass completely smashed out, water all around. Water dripped rhythmically from wood beams above. I lifted up and glided over the gift shop, a flooded mess of soggy, moldy stuffed dolphins and orcas and penguins. Honestly, who the fuck wants an effigy of those fat assholes in their home? Floating postcards, shell pillows, otter and Puget Sound-themed t-shirts. Display stands lay submerged on their sides. I found Nemo, waterlogged with his face ripped off and stuffing erupting from his stomach. He had been lodged between the soggy paperbacks of a book display this whole time. As I dove farther into the building, Dennis's barks became strangled, disembodied, the warnings of a fading ghost. I passed over some sort of stony structure, a highly accurate recreation of a rock pool. I hopped down to inspect closer and found several starfish, tangerine and cherry-colored, alive and living a quiet, thoughtful existence in the dark. Dead stingrays floated in the pools, a couple of chunks missing from their slate bodies. Anemones also lay dead in the water, tentacles stiff and unfeeling. A giant glass half-moon arch, now smashed through its middle, had spilled its watery contents, adding to the murky flooding below. A clear body, impaled on the edge of the arch's broken middle, told me it used to contain jellyfish. What had happened here? I swooped into a walkway hidden in a cave tunnel that used to house a row of aquariums. The caves were flooded, every single aquarium face smashed out. Emerging from the tunnel, I flew over a decimated standalone Hawaiian fish aquarium and straight into the teeth of a great white shark. I squawked and shot back, startled by the mofo-made shark model suspended up high from the wood beams. His ghoulish grimace suggested he was laughing at the aquarium's destruction. I circled back near the rock pools and hopped on top of another glass structure. This one was two tanks connected by a glass tube tunnel. The water inside was green and viscous, greedy algae slime licking all surfaces. This aquarium was remarkably intact, though closer inspection revealed several nuts and bolts at the bottom of the tank. The top of the aquarium had been removed. Something had found its way out. The flood below me rippled, frenzied splashes flicking up spray. Fish! A school of fish were fleeing! A glance at the rock pool revealed hysteria among the remaining sea stars. Sea star panic is very subtle, but I was on to that shit. My feathers ruffled. Hello?
You idiot! Stop calling out to predators! How much of a douche canoe can you be?
A sound. The sound of a mofo hand wiping squeakily across glass. I hopped on one foot atop the tank, readying to take flight. A voice, strange and modulated, cut through the silence like a hot knife.
I've been waiting for you.